Welcome to Fairbanks Arts Review. I'm your host, Robert Gilfillan. Tonight, we'll find out why
artists like basketball players,
as well as discover about the art of fearlessness.
People are very interested in fear. One of the main questions we always get is, how do you deal with your fear? And what is this thing called courage or bravery?
And we'll end up looking at the pictures in the hallway. So why not stay glued to your radio for Fairbanks Arts Review? The relationship between the artist and the land is a venerable one, and all punning aside, a natural one for Alaskan artists. But there is always the danger that their treatment of the vistas we enjoy can become tawdry and commonplace variations on a single theme, grandeur. In the work of Tim Ames, however, I found the focus of his landscapes restrained with an interest in the buildings and structures that reside on the land. The title of his show, which opens next Friday at Ascension Gallery, is The Suburban Bush. And I asked him why he was drawn to the land as a subject for his art.
I've always been affected by photography more than painting styles, as much as anything. I've always gotten a lot of satisfaction out of representational art. I used to do a lot of scribbling and doodling like everybody tries, and have always come back to representational, partly because I love to communicate one way or the other. I like to talk, I like theater. And I feel that a lot of times abstract art ended up being such a private art that the communication was never quite connected. I like to connect up immediately with people and in ways that affect them immediately. I think the content of art in the area today and realism, and that's a problem that I see a lot of times. I won't get specific, God help me, I would get in trouble. Going to galleries today and seeing what people choose to paint. There are quite a few realists in the galleries, mainly because that's the type of art that sells. And I believe in a healthy
pocketbook.
Healthy pocketbook, a healthy mix of art and commerce. And so I believe in also the concept that you sell art. You sell it in the most abstract realm. You have to get it across to people in a way that they understand. So I enjoy realistic art that way. But I also feel that it would be, I feel especially, a need to record in a way that artists should be able to record, not photographers. Not writers, not movie makers. What is going on around us? The Dutch did that in the 16th century. They just started shoveling up these impressive scenes, the parties of the time, the moments that are seldom recorded in a way that recorded emotionally, I think. That some realists are coming around to nowadays too, and partly I found that I love local subjects. I've gotten tighter and tighter over the years until, just in the past 2-3 years, I've been working almost solely of things in the valley.
I'm reminded of Cézanne, and how he would always paint, and suddenly the name of the mountain escapes me. But he attacked in various ways to represent that mountain, capturing it at different angles, different lights, but it was always as if it's a completely new subject matter for him.
That's true. I think a lot of the Impressionists did that. Monet, for the last 40 years of his life, spent that time on his estate. And as time went by, partly because of age and partly, I think, because he was seeing more, he went tighter and tighter and tighter and until he had a wealth of information simply in his own little estate area. He wouldn't leave it. He painted his lily pond and the garden path.
What does the landscape say to you, or what does the land say to you that you want to capture in a landscape painting?
I had a resurgence of, if that's a good word for that, of interest in doing landscape work, partly through Howard Ringley, who was a photographer here in this area, and we talked a lot, we visited, and he started showing me a lot of images from his time up in the Brooks Range. I think that was the first point, seeing the naked landscape, finding the contours of the body and finding the contours of the land and understanding why, the whys of each, understanding the musculature underneath, understanding the order of the foliage. It's funny, I spent some time in Hawaii, and it seems chaotic. The jungle growth is chaotic, and I come back here and I find a great deal of order in the way that the land is made up, down to the tundra. I like that. I study that a bit.
That has something to do with, I guess, survival of the fittest or something like that. I mean, the structure and order, I mean, it's not that sort of warm, moist, fecund atmosphere
right,
to allow anything to grow. Only that which can adapt itself to order, to order itself to the environment.
Well, down there, it's almost a catastrophic growth. It doesn't allow for, yeah, a lot of this growth has been very slow in getting that kind of order developed. It's had to go through many, many generations. Even the tundra bogs, cranberry bogs, takes a long time to get to that point.
And that's what fascinates me a lot of times about the land, is just there's this haunting substratum of order and structure and connections that aren't readily apparent, but under a keen eye is brought out.
Though there is something about the country here is that if you didn't have something immediately to give you a clue, I've been told by people that this country is very much like northern New England. Some of the tree life, it's a little more stunted, but it's still very close in that way. That's one of the things that I like. I think that the landscape here in the valley is not particularly spectacular, and it is usually the goal of many artists to create a spectacular scene. And part of the show statement, the idea of the show, is the suburban bush. And I found that the land has been changed a great deal in this immediate vicinity by people living here. We never think about the fact that 80 years ago the country was almost stripped clean. Whenever the original power plant came in, up until they opened up the railway line and brought coal in from Healy, the power plant was using 9,000 cords of wood a year. When you think about how much
more than I could split in a day.
Yes. And it was an average of 30 cords a day, in fact. And with that kind of use, the entire area was stripped. And then what happens is now, in growing back, it has changed. We've altered the land around us so that even the very landscape is different because of us. I'm also interested in a lot of the buildings in the area.
Will you use different mediums to express different subject matters? For example, will you use an oil as opposed to a watercolor if there's something you want to portray? I mean, will that tell something more readily, or can you express yourself more easily in...
The watercolor is hard to talk about because I'm just starting again. Working with it, and I'm changing my style a great deal with it too.
It's a mixed medium show, though, right?
Yes. Acrylic, watercolor, and oil. I spent several years working in acrylic. I find that whenever I work in acrylic, I work small. Usually, the subject matter is 16 by 20 or smaller, and that's partly because in working with the acrylic, I found you have to work very fast. The acrylic dries very fast, and so that's a disadvantage for me because I'm slow-witted whenever I paint. And I do like that time to be able to develop a layer. But that's the other thing, is that acrylic can be developed in tones, in layers, in washes, and the detailing is much easier to develop. You can get much further painting an acrylic painting in one session. It takes a great deal of patience to paint oils because you have to think ahead, let something lay for a day, and then come back to lay in that detail. Sometimes for me, that's very boring, laying in that background before I can get to the real fun of it, the pulling in of color and pulling in those fine points. And the watercolor is the same way. I'm finding that I'm having much more control with watercolor. And so, yes, I'm choosing doing buildings more that way. It's funny, I didn't want to start doing it that way. I'm not particularly ordered myself. And I've really enjoyed the discipline of having to paint something like a building, like glassware. I did a still life as an exercise. Hated it. I go into a rage whenever I try to match up the sides of a violin. So.
Well, Rossetti's teacher made him sit down and just paint bottles day after day after day after day because he wanted to develop, I guess, that technique or that attention to or the discipline of it. And when you look at his paintings now, and any of those Pre-Raphaelites, you know, they have nice technique, but you can see probably Rossetti never painted another bottle in his life after that. He said, no way.
You know, I always think about artists like basketball players.
That's a fitting analogy.
There. Oh, yeah. You want me to try it?
Yeah, I'd like to see this one pulled out.
Well, a basketball player will spend hundreds of hours practicing. You never see that practice. What you are seeing when you're in a game and you're amazed at his work, you wonder where it comes from. It's as though his body has stored up, his mind has stored up so many moves and maneuvers that they come faster than he can think. And the same happens with an artist. It's very difficult to ask why of a style sometimes, simply because it is developed as a series of moves. An artist is always working on their feet. You don't know what the next maneuver is going to be. So there is the hitting with the brush on the canvas, and the surprise every time of what has happened, and the recording of that information faster than the consciousness can take it in, so that the next time it comes out, hopefully that technique, that's where the technique comes from.
All right. Well, let me ask you this question then. Who do you think would win the toss-off, Toulouse-Lautrec or Magic Johnson? Come on, be real honest here. I think we ought to have a playoff. That was the artist Tim Ames discussing his work, which will be on display September 28th through October 16th at the Ascension Gallery, 558 Gaffney. One of the questions which is asked of Marshall Clymer is, what's so artistic about the martial arts? He's a Sifu of the Chinese art Tai Chi Chuan. Now, Sifu can variously be interpreted as master or teacher. It's a title he earned after 7 years of study with a Chinese master. He's now been honing his art for 15 years, and he's in town this week to give some demonstrations of Tai Chi. Now, Tai Chi, for those who have seen it, probably conjures up visions of people moving slowly and gracefully in a dance without music. But what I wanted to know when I talked with Marshall was what the name Tai Chi Chuan really meant.
Tai Chi Chuan, the double fish symbol, black and white symbol, which is often referred to as the yin-yang symbol, which is a misnomer, is actually by the Chinese called the Tai Chi. And the art was named after that symbol. The symbol has been in existence for 4,000 years or so, and the art itself is the new kid on the block. It's only been around for about 1,000 years. And Tai Chi means grand ultimate or supreme ultimate. It's a philosophical concept of the original source, and from that, the powers of yin and yang create the myriad things. Now, the art, Taiji Chuan. Chuan means fist and refers to any of the pugilistic art forms in China, which has popularly become known as Kung Fu. So if you speak of Taiji, you're talking about the philosophical concept of that double fish symbol. If you speak of the art, you're speaking of Taiji Chuan, which means grand ultimate fist. Basically, the founders of the art recognized a good marketing ploy when they had this art and when they had this symbol, and they decided that they had the supreme ultimate boxing form, and so they named it after the already existing symbol.
Oh, pretty smart PR.
You bet. It also matches, the art also matches the philosophical concepts of yielding, which is involved in the Taiji, which is one of the main concepts of Taiji Chuan in the martial art world. Its contribution to the concept of yielding in the face of a stronger force.
Which brings us round rather readily to the fact that this is an arts program. And you were talking to me earlier in the hallway, and someone came up to you and asked you at one time, well, what is the art form? Why do they call it martial arts? And I think that anybody who hasn't studied the martial arts may be hard-pressed to explain what the artistic aspects are of any martial art, but it seems to me that even just on superficial appearances, Tai Chi has an elegance of form and movement that may be more accessible to everybody. Where do you think the art comes from when they say martial art?
What's happened in the history of the martial arts over the last 1,000 years or so is that it has gone from being primarily a means of self-defense in a fighting context to a more healthful process in terms of discovering character attributes, and it has changed its emphasis from fighting to health, rejuvenation, and such. I study the Yang form of Tai Chi Chuan, which is named after the Yang family. And the Yang family felt very strongly that with the advent of the firearm, that the martial arts, as such, were obsolete, and that concentration should be on health, meditation, things like this. Now, what the Yangs did was continue the training in the martial aspects, but only in private, and they didn't talk about it, and they didn't show it, because it would draw negative attention. But people say, well, what are the aspects of this inherent fighting form? What makes it an art? It's the process that makes it an art more than anything else. What we are taking is a raw product in terms of a human being, and giving them the process to realize greater potential. And within that, there is an artistic process in terms of layering. You discover one aspect of the art, the initial aspect that you study. You see it like an onion. And then, as you study it closely, you peel that initial layer away, and you come to another layer. And you study that layer. And in studying it, you learn more and peel that away, and you come to yet another layer. And this layering upon layering upon layering is inherent in any artistic form. You can study it all your life and continue to realize greater connections and greater depth of understanding. Tai Chi Chuan is no different in that. One anthropologist, Maurice Bauer, once wrote that all true art enhances the desire and strengthens the capacity to live. And this is what Tai Chi Chuan and any of the Kung Fu forms, as they are understood in the New World, are involved in. They're involved in teaching people what their potential is and teaching them how to live with greater realized energy. So in that, it shares similarities. Now, some of my friends suggest that Tai Chi Chuan is an art form too because of the lifestyle that it puts its teachers through. Because the image of the starving artist in a garret is understood by any martial artist. My teacher, Master Choi, who is an elderly Chinese gentleman in Chinatown, San Francisco, once told me when I got to the point of buying my first punching bag that I should fill it with beans, because in the study of any martial art, the artist at some point will go through poverty, and you can always cut your punching bag open and eat it. And so in that sense, my lifestyle is no different than many of my friends who are fine artists or some are involved in some sort of artistic process. We share a similarity in lifestyle. But the process of art, any art, is an investigation of connections between certain things. And the realization of those certain connections and the ability to repeat a process and achieve similar results over and over and over. It's very little different than any science in that aspect. And the martial arts are no different than any of the other artistic forms that I've studied, which is dance and theater, and I was a performing artist for many, many years. So it's process more than anything else that makes the martial arts an art. But the thing about it that is different than the other arts is that the individual is both the artist and the product of the artistic process. And it's hard to put yourself up on a palette or something like this. But in effect, what you're doing is creating an artistic piece in yourself. You're like a performing artist. You are... your body is the tool and is the product of that tool.
But with Tai Chi Chuan, I noticed there's always been, as long as I can remember, references to it, mm-hmm. a nurturing quality, a spiritual quality, a meditative quality mm-hmm. associated with it. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Is that historically?
There's a couple of reasons for that. In any meditative form that I've studied, and I've studied several Eastern disciplines, there is a quality of the meditation creating a mindset and an internal concentration which allows for very clear perceptive viewing of what is going on inside this organism that is going through these machinations. And that meditative process allows for a unfiltered, clear viewing of both yourself and your relation to the environment around you, to other people, to other things, to situations. And without the meditative process, there is a tendency to remove yourself from yourself and approach everything from an external view. And that meditative process allows for that quieting of the self so that you can indeed investigate very clearly the depths of your own soul and how you relate to the outside world. And in the Chinese systems, it's always been part of their systems of the martial arts, and is one of the reasons why I originally went into the Chinese martial arts as opposed to any of the other cultural arts. I investigated those, and though meditation played an important part in many, many of them, it was the tradition of having meditation and relaxation as part of the Tai Chi Chuan practice that really attracted me. Master Choi said at one point, "Marshal, if you learn to fight, you will fight. If you learn to relax, you will relax." And that made ultimate sense to me. And the reason that I got into this art was to never fight again. But then we get into the paradox of learning not to fight by learning to fight, which in the West is very, very confusing. In the East, paradoxical logic is accepted as a norm. In the West, we've got to have that solid linear logic, and or we don't understand it. When I first came into the States 7 years ago and referred to what I was doing as soft boxing, I saw more split psyches instantly because they had no idea what I was talking about. And they said, right, this is some California kook here.
Well, as actually a self-defense, Tai Chi is pretty effective, I understand, although I've never ever seen a demonstration mm-hmm. of it as such as a martial art. Mm-hmm. But Peter Ralston, I think is the name, I just heard that he had won some sort of transcultural match using Tai Chi.
Peter was the first non-Asian to win an open tournament in Asia This was back in the late 60s, early 70s perhaps, or mid-70s. And I believe it was in Taiwan, though I'm not absolutely sure about that. Peter had trained in the internal arts, not only Tai Chi Chuan. There are three Chinese internal arts. There is Tai Chi Chuan, Ba Kwa Chuan, and Xing Yi Chuan. To my understanding, Peter had training in all of those. And he took his internal training into this open tournament, in which it was open to all styles. And the tournament has a history of severe injury and even death. It was canceled at one point for many years because of that. Peter went into this and defeated all comers. And the reason Peter created quite a stir was not necessarily just the internal arts, because in Asia, they've been appreciated and respected for generations. Peter's big thing was that he was non-Asian, and it created quite a stir, because we're in our first generation, with myself and my colleagues are in our first generation of non-Chinese teachers now in history. And so we're at a watershed, and those of us who are white sifus are being watched very carefully to see, one, that the traditions are being carried on from east to west, and that they're not being watered down to the point where you're getting what Sifu Choi calls butterfly form, which is insubstantial and kind of fluttery.
How do masters from Asia view contemporary Occidental?
Well, that's a kind of sweeping question, and I could give a sweeping answer, which in some cases would be true and others not. I have, for every Asian who doesn't feel that these arts should be in the hands of non-Asians, there is someone like my teacher, Master Choi, who openly and willingly and lovingly gives it to whoever comes to him, and feels very strongly that with the world becoming as small as it is now, that there is a renaissance going on in the martial arts, and the only way that they can be effective is to see them given out to other than Chinese hands. Now, the reason that Chinese are so hesitant, as a general rule, to see these arts given out is that the bottom line of this training is the development of power, personal power, power over yourself, and ultimately the potential of power over others. This isn't something you give lightly. It's the idea you don't bring a 15-year-old boy and give him a loaded 38 without any training and then tell him to go use it or carry it. The Chinese are very concerned with this, and they've watched the introduction of karate into the United States over the last two decades. And some of the karate has been translated from east to west in technical terms without the underlying philosophical basis in which to place training. And so they're very concerned about this, and they're watching this generation of teachers, of which I'm part, very carefully to see. And so far, so good. What's happened with Tai Chi Chuan, since it's only about 15 years or so out of Chinese hands at this point, is that all of us are playing with finding out how to translate the traditional values into perhaps a faster-paced Western mode. What the Institute has done is make very intense, short courses in which you learn a shortened form from the classical long form. We have a two-month course in which you learn a 30-movement form. And when I first started this 6 years ago, the traditional sifus down in Chinatown just shook their head at me and said I was a nice, idealistic young man and good luck, but they didn't have any hope that anything would come of this. And what has happened in the 6 years that I've been working in Alaska is that we have been able to form a course which graduates 80 to 90% of the people who begin it, which in any martial arts study I've done in the last 15 years is phenomenal. That's largely due to mainly the temper of the people that we have up here. People persevere a little more in Alaska than they do elsewhere. When they set their mind on something, they do it. Come doom of night and rain and all. but also because we've been able to form a course that does maintain the traditional values and the benefits of studying from in a classical setting, which I've had, and yet be a little bit more intense for the Western professional, basically.
Now, when you were talking earlier, you used the metaphor of peeling away the outer skin of an onion.
Mm-hmm.
As I understand it, this is a lifelong study.
Mm.
Where does one go? And I wish you'd talk a little bit more about the Institute and its mm-hmm. and its courses.
Mm-hmm.
But let's say one does pass the shortened course.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that's not where it stops. That's where it starts.
That's where it starts, you bet. Actually, they will tell you, in any of the martial arts that award belts as ranking, they will tell you that your black belt is your beginning. And I can tell you, Robert, that when I got certified after 7 years, my sense was of opening a door and taking a bold new step and just tumbling head over heels into space. And I'm still sort of tumbling now. And it's okay. But it was only after 7 years that I really began feeling like I was beginning to learn. In the Institute, we have this initial study. And if people graduate from that, I recommend that they take it again and again and again. I took the same course for 5 years before I moved on to another course. Then we go through several levels of training, which you gain another form, a 54 movement form, and then you gain, in the third level of training, the 108 classical long form, which takes about 20 minutes to perform. And then you get into two-person application form, which is called joined hands, and then you get into Taiji saber and Taiji sword after that weapons work. And very often when you mention the word Taiji Chuan, people's immediate pictures is of older people in parks, in travel logs in China, doing this slow motion, looks like a dance more than anything else. That's the initial solo exercise of Taiji Chuan. And there is a great deal to study beyond that to gain the various aspects of the art in terms of realizing a greater presence about yourself, through balance, through correct postural alignment, through rooting to the ground, through proper breathing, and through a meditative awareness in your environment. Meditation doesn't mean spaciness. Meditation means a very active involvement in everything around you. And you go through all of these different levels of training, and by the time you come out at the end, 3 to 5 years later, as a general rule, you will have gained insights into yourself in terms of how you learn, how you approach things. You confront fear, you confront resentment, you confront anger within yourself. And the real artistic process is learning how to resolve all those negative emotions and recognize greater potential for good.
I was going to bring up, as a follow-up question to the martial art aspect, that idea that it seems to me most of our culture right now deals with fear as a real basic drive and motivation for action and reaction.
People are very interested in fear. One of the main questions we always get is, how do you deal with your fear? And what is this thing called courage or bravery? And this quote was given to me by a student. It says, courage is often a matter of learning that you can survive doing something that frightens you. Do it often enough and the fear is tamed. And what the martial arts give you is a controlled workshop in which to confront those fears.
Can someone my age or even 45, 50 come to these and expect to?
I'll give you a case in point. I did an intensive weekend workshop down in the Sausalito area, the Bay Area of San Francisco, this summer, and my 67-year-old stroke victim mother put her cane down and did the entire 12 hours in 3 days. And she is now studying with Master Choi. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Now, another slight small tale. When I started, I was 21. And Master Choi just shook his head and said, you too old, you too old. If you practice, maybe you'll be good by the time you're 65. Now, the thing about that is that's the classical Chinese way of teaching. You won't necessarily ever get strokes for what you've done. You will always be goosed a little bit to do more. And my feeling is that no matter when you start, it's the right time. And you have the rest of your life to practice this. The wonderful thing about something as soft as Yang-style Tai Chi Chuan is that you can practice it for the rest of your life. If you can walk, you can do Tai Chi Chuan. My mother is a prime example of that. So my suggestion is, don't worry if you didn't start when you were 4 years old, as they may start in China, whenever it's right. I have students that go from 8 to 80.
Mm-hmm.
And the older people have a tendency to feel like, oh my gosh, I must be getting senile. This is the hardest thing I've ever done. But I can tell you, Robert, I had the same feeling when I was 21 and getting into this. I thought somehow I'd lost my mind, because I was a capable, intelligent, bright human being, and this eluded me for 3 years, and until I began to lose some of the mental baggage I went into the study with. And once that started to go away, then I started learning. My feeling is that whenever you start is good, and I encourage people. I teach differently than I was taught. In a traditional setting, in a classical setting, the teacher treats everybody the same. It's very much like the military. Everybody gets treated like dirt. No, that's not entirely true. But
I know the feeling.
You do get individual nuances are not taken into account initially. Everything is given out to the group, and then the teacher stands back in a traditional setting and watches which students rise to the top through practice and through concentration, whatever, through attitude. And then they concentrate on those students. I teach a little differently because of my Western background. And I give a lot more strokes than I was ever given, or am given even today, because I feel it encourages the learning process. And I also, one of my differences is I use humor a lot in teaching, because I have realized the value of a laugh in terms of opening people up to new ideas. If you can get them to laugh, they relax, and boom, they're immediately receptive to whatever the lesson is. I've been involved in different martial arts for 15 years, and most of them, in the old world way, are done very seriously. And I think, oi, oi, oi. One of the wonderful things in the 17 values, traditional values, that the elders of the spirit movement here in Alaska have put down is that following spirituality is humor. And I think the juxtaposition is a very good thing to keep in mind, because in any search or process of investigating the potential of human spirit, without a sense of humor, not only do you maybe lose the desires in life, but you lose the joy of life. And I think it's very important to keep humor foremost, and I use it in my teaching a lot. And we keep our classes very small. We have no more than 10 people in a class so that we can concentrate on individual attention. One of the things that the study of Tai Chi Chuan will do, as you work on the physical self, it will create and bring up emotional baggage that perhaps is forgotten or undealt with, unresolved. And it can get very confusing and sometimes scary for the individual in terms of having these old emotions re-brought up. But that's the way the martial arts approach the resolution. You bring them up, you confront them, and you resolve them. And through that resolve, you hope for some self-enlightenment or self-knowledge. And without humor, that process is grim. And I find it, you can be honest with yourself, but you don't have to be hard on yourself.
What I'd like to know is, for the people who are listening, where can they learn this form? Now, talk to me for a minute about the Institute, which is based in Anchorage,
mm-hmm.
and how people in Fairbanks can avail themselves of Tai Chi.
Okay, what the Institute has done, the Institute is a nonprofit educational organization. We don't consider ourselves a school. If I was naming the Institute at this point in time, I would probably name it the Arctic Institute of Conflict Resolution, because Tai Chi Chuan is not my main concern with the Institute. A public education about nonviolent conflict resolution is what we at the Institute are interested in doing. And we have people going all over the state now, establishing seminars, workshops, clubs, and classes. The workshops and the classes, we use Tai Chi Chuan as a vehicle, but the main message is that there is to talk on violence, how violence affects us, and what effective use of nonviolent means of conflict resolution we have at our disposal and that we can use. Much of our work is talk, and the classes and the workshops in Tai Chi Chuan basically are our money-making arm of the Institute. But my interest more than anything else at this point in my training and my practice is in seeing a public education on violence and nonviolent conflict resolution. So there's been a collection of concerned Alaskans that have gone together and formed the Institute. And we have for about 5 or 6 years now in Anchorage held regular ongoing classes and seminars and lectures and such. And just last year began our second 5-year plan of the Institute, and we started establishing intensive workshops and ongoing clubs in Kodiak and Fairbanks. And that process is going on this year, 1985. We have plans to establish demonstrations and workshops and ongoing clubs in Homer, Kotzebue, Palmer, and Girdwood, as well as continue the Kodiak and the Fairbanks workshops. So this, and there is an active club up here in Fairbanks now. In fact, it is the most active chapter besides the Anchorage-based chapter that the Institute has right now. It's quite a gung-ho group up here, and it's very exciting for me to come up here and work with them. I look forward to my trips to Fairbanks every time. And we're going to be giving a series of workshops this year. We have one intensive weekend workshop a season. We have one in the spring, or one in the autumn, one in the winter, one in the spring. And those three weekend workshops, will people who complete all of them will take them through this 30-movement introductory form. Plus, they get breathing exercises and basic stance work. And it's an immersion technique of teaching, which I found very valuable, because after about 12 hours in a weekend, nobody, even the most resistant of bodies and mindsets, has to give up, and things begin to be assimilated, sometimes on a subliminal basis. But the immersion technique of teaching is real valuable and has worked throughout Alaska and throughout the lower 48 where I've given workshops. And then there are clubs which meet weekly up here. The individuals who have been studying now, one of them, one of the individuals in the Fairbanks group was one of my original students 6 years ago when I first came into the state. And it's quite an active group. I refer to them affectionately as the Fairbanks Irregulars, because they are a motley group, but they have spirit that is just inspirational. And they are they're organizing this next series of workshops, which we will introduce another 15 or 20 people into the form.
Well, then, I have a notice in front of me about the public demonstrations and about the workshops, so maybe we should give some dates with regard to those. It shows here that on Friday at the Commons Lounge here on the campus at UAF, you'll be having a demonstration from noon to 1 p.m., and that's September 21st. And then on Sunday, September 23rd, between 3 and 5 p.m. at Noel Wien Library Auditorium, there'll be another demonstration. And then I guess in October is when
the initial workshop will take place on the weekend of October 19th, 20th, and 21st. And it will involve a 12-hour commitment. And we'll meet 2 hours on Friday night, I believe 6 hours Saturday, and 4 hours Sunday. So it involves a weekend, but I have found that this kind of structure actually takes less time to learn the form than would weekly classes or several classes a week. That tends to take more time and be more difficult to schedule for. By scheduling one weekend every season, even the busiest lifestyle can very often schedule for something like this. And we will be starting that workshop, as I said, the 19th, 20th, and 21st. And we do have limited enrollment. I have told the people up here that I don't want any more than 15 people in the workshop. They assure me they have about 20 right now, and we haven't even begun to publicize. If there are more than 15, what we'll do is just bring up more assistance from Anchorage and from the group here, from the club here in Fairbanks, to work. We begin to get into space problems if we get too big. Plus, I feel very strongly that this art is subtle and is complicated, and so needs strong individual attention. And I like to keep the workshop small for that reason. I'm more interested in people who are seriously interested in working than people who are dabbling. Myself, I dabbled for years and years. My mother used to call me a spiritual dilettante.
Mine still does.
But I'm really interested in people who are willing to commit themselves to a weekend and see what this is. Now, this course that I've designed is for people who have never heard of this, don't even know how to spell it, have never seen it.
So you really go from ground zero.
Ground zero. It's also designed for people who have studied other forms, other schools, other styles. And we have people who come in, as I say, with no information at all, and then people who have trained extensively, either in Tai Chi Chuan or another art. So what I do is approach each of the individuals in the workshop as an individual and attempt to give them what they need based on where they are and their understanding.
But what about if people want to know about conflict resolution and nonviolent...
During these demonstrations that will be given at the Commons Lounge on September 21st and at Noel Wien Library on the 23rd, most of the time taken up in these demonstrations are me talking about conflict resolution. We will demonstrate the 30-movement form, and I will probably demonstrate it weapons form, probably Tai Chi Saber. But my main interest is in this public education on violence and nonviolent conflict resolution.
So people who attend then can find out about the Institute.
Sure, you bet. And we're open for questions and answers. My very strong belief is that you should always question authority.
That was Marshall Clymer, a master of the Chinese art of Tai Chi Chuan. He'll be demonstrating his art tomorrow afternoon at the Commons Lounge at the University, noon to 1 p.m., and on Sunday from 3 to 5 p.m. at the Noel Wien Library Auditorium. For more information, call 488-9129 or 474-7680. Playing at Fairbanks Drama Association for the next three nights is Sean O'Casey's Pictures in the Hallway. Now, normally this is something I might review, but since I am a member of the cast, I thought some of you might doubt the honesty of my glowing description of the production. So I asked Pat Monahan to come along and review the play for our show. She's reviewed plays before, as well as just returning from a summer in Ireland.
Pictures in the Hallway is adapted by Paul Shire from one of the volumes of Sean O'Casey's autobiography. I think O'Casey was one of the great autobiographers of the century, possibly because he lived at such interesting times. He was the second great playwright of the Abbey Theatre in Ireland, which was formed both for artistic and actually political reasons as a move toward Irish nationalism, the first great playwright being John Millington Synge. That is, if you accept the idea that what Yeats was writing was not really plays. They don't play well. They're sort of artifacts of the theater now. But certainly John Millington Synge was a great playwright of the Abbey. And then Sean O'Casey, they're very different. O'Casey coming from a lower-class Dublin background and Synge being interested in the myth and folklore of the country people. Singh is very eloquent and poetic, and O'Casey is more conversational and to some extent quaint or local colorish to us, also much more political than Singh was. And this part of his autobiography shows him kind of coming to consciousness as a young man in Dublin and the beginnings of the political ferment that would wind up with the rising and the eventual foundation of the Irish Republic. The play is reader's theater, which means that it isn't a full-scale production in the sense that we usually think of. There are sections from the autobiography arranged for the readers to evoke conversations and so forth. They're acted out, but then the narration is provided by two readers on either side of the stage, Laurie Rowland to our left and Richard Ussery to our right, both of whom did a commendable job. Before we went in, people were muttering in the hallway saying, I hope they don't do it in a dreadful bad Irish accent. There was real concern by people going into the play as to whether or not it would be either difficult to understand or badly done. I'll have to say I was probably one of the more tough members of the audience, having been right off the boat from a summer in Ireland. And there is really nothing like the Irish speech. As an American, you begin to feel like blobs of speech are coming out of your mouth. It is so lilting and beautiful that you really find it, it's like being in a linguistic fairyland. It's really a beautiful kind of English. I forget, it's been several years since I was in Ireland, I forget just how lovely it is to just sit around and listen to people converse in their beautiful brogues. So I had the same apprehension as other people going in, that this might be a mangled language, particularly as sensitized as I was to the beauty of the Irish use of English. It was really well done. The brogues were slight. They were not overdone. There was no Shirin Bagora stuff, thank goodness. And yet it did lack the kind of pulse of the Irish speech. I don't think that can be reproduced by anything other than being one. I don't think that it can be learned. So it was not Irish. Well, it was not the Irish English. But it was a commendable variation on it. It was not hard to understand, and sometimes the heavily accented Irish speech can be hard to understand. It was clear. It was very like English. The pronunciations were correct. The fault I would find is that it didn't sing, no pun intended. It didn't have the kind of lightness and charm that Irish speech in Ireland does. Laurie Rowland came very close. There was a kind of charm to her speaking voice that almost got there. This is a play about the politics that led to the risings of earlier this century. O'Casey was heavily involved himself, and of course the island was involved at that time in separating from England. And I'm really glad it was not stage Irish and cute. Had it been, it would have been a disaster. There's so much eloquence in his writing that it could easily have gone that way. At the same time, I felt that there wasn't the kind of bitterness and double-edgedness to the acting that would capture the reasons for the rising. The acting was extremely even, and in a community theater performance, I think it's very hard to get a cast which performs as evenly as that one did. You didn't go out of there saying, well, so-and-so was the best actor. And so many times in a performance put on by non-professional actors volunteering their time, you'll have several actors who are so much better than the rest of the cast that everybody can say afterwards who the good actors were. In this case, the direction and the casting was so good that you never had a feeling that one actor was outshining the other by such an amount that you would notice it. It was extremely even production. And that goes to the costumes and the sets and everything, the lighting, everything was even. There were no drastic differences. Even and competent and all at a quite high level. There was just a fineness to the cohesiveness of that production that made it real easy to just get into watching the play. So instead of watching the production, we're really watching that play, which was really a real pleasure in a small town with a community theater like that. The one thing that I felt was missing was that below the surface of the charm and the leprechaun-ness, there is seething violence. I would say, for example, that the moment when the two women are gossiping and looking down at the woman down the street who has just painted her door, thereby showing them all up, and they're gossiping about her, and they're saying, ah, well, she's a lovely soul. Ah, well, you know, may she be happy in heaven, and so forth. That should be much more wicked than it came across. That it was a cute, quaint vignette, but that to me was one of the most typically Irish moments, where the surface is very nice and they seem to be saying one thing, but in fact they're really saying something else and something much meaner. The scene with the Tinker Woman, which Melinda Mattson plays, all of the characters play many parts, and at this point Melinda has made the transition from playing O'Casey's mother to playing an old tinker woman who gets him in trouble at work. And it was, it lacked an edge of craziness that really does exist, I think, in Ireland, and is the source of a lot of the troubles. That it never quite had the point, you never as an audience felt that it might sort of tip over into violence. It was an argument. And because this was something that was going to wind up with him essentially losing his job, being forced to resign or be fired, it had to have more stuff there. And it never quite got to the point where you believed that something really awful was about to happen on that stage. There was this kind of crazy tinker woman, and she was kind of acting like a bully, and he kind of insulted her. And then all these things happened. But why was that the moment that was going to show that he had this this thing in him that was not going to stand to be pushed around? I would think that it would be very hard to act in that duplicitous way that showed that underneath you were saying something completely different than what your mouth was saying. But I think that would add a kind of touch of bitterness and depth to the performance. To summarize, I'd say that the production is marvelously well, the actors are well matched, they're well directed, the play moves seamlessly through the events of the young man's life. It's a well done performance. What would make it excellent would be to have more of the depth and the bitterness enter in there.
That was Pat Monahan reviewing Fairbanks Drama Association's current production, Pictures in the Hallway, which is playing tonight through Saturday. For ticket information, just call 456-PLAY. Well, that's all for tonight's show. Join us again in 2 weeks for another look at the art scene in Fairbanks. For KUAC, I'm Robert Gilfillan. Good night.